This interview, Ken Norman, who was an ex-RAF buccaneer and camera pilot, shares his stories about flying the two types. He includes his squadrons, which are 31, 16 and 208. He also gives a great insight into flying the buccaneer over at Red Flag at Nellis Air Force Base. So please subscribe and enjoy.
My father's in the Air Force, but it never occurred to me to be a pilot. In fact, I went to boarding school and when I was 16, I left after my O-levels and I joined the Merchant Navy.
Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, I did a four-year apprenticeship with Elder Dempster Lines, 2 years in Liverpool at Riversdale Technical College, doing an OND in marine engineering, and then a year at sea, followed by a year at college again, so it was a four-year apprenticeship.
So what happened after that?
Well, I did two trips to sea, the first one down to Nigeria, and the second one to Burma, that's Myanmar now, I think, and Rangoon, I think it's called Yangon now. And I was getting a bit disillusioned, I have to say, with it being at sea. It's not what I expected to be. I wanted to travel and see the world and be an engineer, but unfortunately working down the engine room of some of the ships I was on was a bit of a nightmare, to say the least. So I was looking to for another career, and after my second trip, I came back to Shorebury. That's where my father was stationed at the time, Shorebury. And I bumped into an old friend of mine, a young lady who had a boyfriend with her, a boyfriend, a chap called Kevin Mace. And I asked him what he did, and he said, "I'm a pilot in the Air Force." I said, "Oh, really?" I said, "Well, what sort of airplanes are you flying?" He said, "Well, I'm going through training at Valley at the moment, flying the NAT." So I was quite interested, so I asked him about what the qualifications were for the Royal Air Force. And I dashed off home, got an application form for the Air Force, and fired it off. And I put a covering letter in it saying, "I'll be back at sea for 3 months, going back to Burma again. If we get an interview, could I come down after 3 months?" So when I got back after that trip, waiting for me at the, when I got home, was a letter from the Air Force saying, "Come along for an interview, for a 3-day interview." So I immediately rushed off and bought the Know Your Own IQ book, where you can actually go through all the IQ tests to give you a bit of a heads up for the interview. And I went down to Biggin Hill for 3 days, and it went quite well. I mean, the usual tests, the leadership tests, and the IQ tests, and the coordination tests, and finally the interview. And at the interview, they said to me, "Obviously you want to be a pilot, but what's your second choice?" And I said, "Well, I don't have a second choice." They said, "Well, you must put a second choice down." So I said, "Well, my second choice is staying in the Merchant Navy." So I left and went home again. I thought maybe I'd been a bit cheeky there. But anyway, I left and went back to sea again. And I went, this voyage was down to Nigeria, down to Sapele. And we're picking up Sapele pine in Sapele, loading onto the ship. Well, I got a telex from a father saying, "Congratulations, Ken, you start the Royal Air Force as a pilot 8th September 1966. So it was superb. You know, there are two things to celebrate then, really. One was that I was joining the Air Force, and the other one was that I didn't have to go back to bloody Nigeria again.
So could you tell us when your training started for
the RAF? It started 8th of September 66, and surprisingly, I didn't go to South Cerny, which is the initial training school. I went north to Moroy Sea School. Air Force decided to send me for a month outward bound, which is a bit bizarre, really. I just left the Merchant Navy and I was going to the sea school when I joined the Royal Air Force. But I had 28 days there and it was fabulous. You know, it was one of those, you know, sort of outward bound that everyone wants to do. You know, you did sailing. We'd get up in the morning, in fact. We'd get up in the morning, 6 o'clock in the morning, and we would run for 3 miles and then come back for a hearty breakfast, then go down the docks and sail the cutter or in the kayaks or the canoes. So we'd spend a lot of time down the docks. Or we'd go up into the hills and we were doing mountain climbing, we were doing rock climbing, abseiling, and we spent a bit of time actually walking and camping in the Cairngorm. So it was incredible, 28 days, I loved it, you know, and it was well worth doing.
So could you tell us what aircraft you trained on?
Yes, I mean, obviously, initially did the 8-10 week course at South Cerny, which is just an officer training school, and then went to Church Fenton to fly the Chipmunk.
What was that like?
That was an intensive course. It was 30 hours flying in about 30 days. So you flew sometimes 3 times a day. It was a lovely airplane to fly. I mean, initially when you first flew it, of course, it was a bit of a fiddly airplane to land. It was a tailwheel airplane, so you had to land it in a three-point attitude. But once you got that hacked and a bit of circuit training, then we're off doing general handling. and the general handling was just generally obviously a bit of steep turns, etc. But we started doing aerobatics, and of course that's when it was a lovely airplane to fly. You know, loops, barrels, stall turns. It's just a great airplane. Sarsden, obviously that's your wings course, and it's about, I think it's about 11 months the course was, and it was a lovely airplane to fly. It was a straight wing airplane, all manual controls. And the course initially, of course, was just general handling. You did circuit training and learning to land the aeroplane, which is actually a lot easier to land than the chipmunk. And then, say, upper air work. And then, say, an instant rating, a white rating you'd do. That meant you could fly in all sorts of weathers. And then from there, we started doing NAVEXs, medium-level NAVEXs, and then onto formation flying and obviously onto aerobatics, which I loved. And to me, it is important that you do as much aerobatics as possible, because you got streamed after basic training, either onto Oakington, which was for transport aircraft, or to Valley, which is a fast jet, really. So in my mind, it's important to turn the aeroplane upside down as often as possible. And I remember one of the last trips I did, I was flying with standards, OC standards, and he briefed me that we'll get airborne, and we'll do general handling, and we'll do QGHs, da 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 da. And when we got airborne, he said, "Ken, what do you want to do?" And I said, "Aerobatics." And he says, "Fine." And he showed me his aerobatic sequence. And then I did mine, and we spent hours doing aerobatics. And when we came into land, he says, "Where do you want to go, Ken?" I said, "Valley." He says, "Well, we'll see what happens." And so I subsequently got posted to Valley. So I arrived at Valley, which is a great place to be in Anglesey. Parked the car and immediately walked down to the end of the runway. I started watching the aeroplanes land. I couldn't believe I'd finally arrived at Valley to fly the NAT. The course initially was a lot of ground school. The NAT was quite a more complicated aeroplane. It had power controls and hydraulic controls, etc. So we spent a time in the ground school learning about the NAT, and then we did, I think, about 10 sessions in the simulator before we flew the aeroplane. And then that was a delight. I mean, you walked out of the aeroplane, and as they always said, you don't actually strap into a NAT, you actually put it on. And it was like that. It was just a tiny little aeroplane. And the nice thing about it was that it was a tandem seating. So when you got into the aeroplane, you sat there and there was nobody else with you. So you always felt that you were flying solo. So at the end of the course, I did quite well, I suppose. And I was actually posted onto Harriers.
Okay. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, initial posing in Harriers, and a couple of my mates went onto Lightnings. But before I left Valley, I was informed that the Harrier course had been delayed enormously because they had problems with the Harrier. So they said, "Would you do a short course on the Canberra?" I said, "Yeah, no problem at all. I loved it. I'd been training then for about 3 years, so I was quite keen to get on a squadron."
Ken chats about flying the English Electric Canberra.
So off I went to Cottesmore to join the Canberra OCU. A bit of a culture shock, to say the least. It had come from the NAT to the Canberra. Canberra, of course, had no power controls at all. It had, I think, hydraulics for the raising the undercarriage, and I think maybe for the air brakes, I think. But the rest was all manual controls. And I remember the wheel brakes were actually air-driven, I think. They were a strange system. Anyway, the first time I got into the T4, you'd go in the T4, which is the one around the corner there, and you'd strap in, and you can see the big bubble canopy. Well, there's a great feeling that when you're in there, because you're to the left-hand side of the cockpit, you had your head to one side like this, you know. And then the instructor would get in, and his seat was folded right back, and he would pull the seat forward, and then strap in, and then take the pins out. And so we started the engines, and I said the brakes on the Canberra were air brakes. The way you operated the brakes, there was no nose wheel steering. You would put the rudder on and you'd squeeze the paddle on the control wheel, and the brakes would come on and you'd just turn the airplane that way. But it was a bit fierce, and I remember taxiing down the taxiway with a head like this, and every time I put the brakes on, we're doing this all the way down the taxiway. And I thought to myself, "I can't even steer this bloody thing," and he expects me to fly it. So we taxed out eventually and got airborne. And it was fabulous, you know, got airborne. It was a delight to fly. It was one of those aeroplanes. It was just a gentleman's aeroplane, really. A big wing, big straight wing aeroplane, manual controls. And it was great. Loved flying the Canberra.
So can you tell us a bit about your first flight in the Canberra?
Well, so that was the first flight. And in fact, the more interesting flight was about four trips later that I explained to you that the instructor gets into the aeroplane and he brings his seat forward. But on my fourth trip on the Canberra, I rotated. As I rotated to about 50 feet, the instructor's seat unlocked and it just flew backwards. And I was flying this aeroplane and this instructor, it was flapping around on his seat. And it was ashen, you know, because this seat was fully armed. It could have gone off. So I couldn't do much for him. So I just held the aeroplane and climbed away. And he eventually managed to get the seat back up and locked in position. I shouldn't laugh because had it gone off, it would have been a very messy business, really. But that was my fourth trip in the Canberra.
So what were your first thoughts of the Canberra? Like, did you like it?
Yeah, it was different. It was, you know, I'd come from the NAT and it was a totally different aeroplane. We were flying the aeroplane, it was manual controls, which of course, manual controls is a bit more stiff on the controls and you can't do as much with the aeroplane. Obviously, not as manoeuvrable as a NAT, etc. So, but no, for what it was a great aeroplane. And I went solo on it and then joined up with my NAV, Nobby Clark, and then we did a lot of flights together. It was just low level, really. It was getting the guy in the back, it would get airborne, and then he'd crawl into the nose of a B2 and would do navexes around the UK. So, yeah, it was great fun. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
So how long did you spend on the OCU?
I think about 4 months, probably, 4 or 5 months. Yeah, it was about 4 or 5 months. And it was just concentrated flying the whole time at Cottesmore. So I loved it.
So how long did you, how many times did you fly a week, for instance?
I think probably 2 or 3 times a week, probably, I think. I can't remember the hours. I think we did about 60, 70 hours on the Canberra, probably on the OCU, before we left to go to Germany.
So after the OCU, where did you get posted to?
I was posted to 31 Squadron in RAF Germany. So I piled all my bags into my Mark 1 Frog Eye Sprite and headed off for Germany. I had no maps or anything like that, I just headed for Germany. So I went across the channel and arrived in Germany and I eventually found Lahrbruck and checked in the officer's mess.
So what was the role of 31 Squadron?
31 Squadron was obviously a recce squadron and I suppose photographic reconnaissance squadron. I suppose there are three roles. There was a low level photographic role and then there was a medium level sort of vertical photography role, which was sort of a mapping survey role, and then there was a night flashing role, which was actually night photography. So those are the three roles. Well, we'd take off, say, from I'll go through a sort of typical trip, really. We'd take off from Lahrbruck and we'd have planned a target. Now, the target's generally not as a target, but an area to photograph. And we're either doing bridges, you know, or locks or missile sites or troops on the ground. So what you'd do, you would get airborne and then you'd fly over the target, say troops on the ground. And when you flew over the target, you'd obviously photograph it. At the same time, you'd take a mental picture in your mind of what you saw at the time. Obviously, you do that for simple reason. The cameras might fail. Or you might get battle damage, so you may not have the photographs when you get back. So when you landed back at Lahrbruck, the crews would meet the ground liaison officer, who was an army guy, and you'd do what we call it a visrep, a visual report, and you'd sit down, you'd write down what you saw. And it's obviously fairly easy if you're doing bridges and locks and things like that. But once you get into the field and you look at the army, it's quite a complex picture you take in your mind. You can have tanks, you can have all sorts of various vehicles there, and you have to identify those vehicles and put them on your visrep. So you'd fill your visrep in and then the photographs would go off to the MUFPU. The MUFPU was the Mobile Field Photographic Unit, number 3 photographic unit, and you have PIs there and they develop the photographs and they'd look through the 3D scopes and they could see exactly what's on the ground. And then they would actually look at your visrep and assess it against the photograph, and you were marked. So you showed me what percent, you know, how right and wrong you were. After some of the guys there, you know, like Mike Jameson, the guys like that, they were sharp cookies. They'd come back and they'd have great marks. But I was just starting out with Nobby, you know, and we were pretty amateur at it, really. But we did better as time went by. We got better and better and better. But I say it was only a year on the squadron. So we didn't have time to really up to a really high standard like a lot of the guys there who were on the squadron.
So, can you tell us what it was like to fly the Canberra, some of its good characteristics and bad characteristics?
Well, a very stable aeroplane. You know, it's we used to fly at 270 knots, I think, right? 270 knots, like that. And really, I suppose you're limited to the height you flew at. You could get low. You took a lot of happy snaps down at 50 feet, you know, but obviously the Canberra, you know, you're going past the target fast, then the image is not going to be the same. You're going to get a bit blurring, and there's no image stabilisation at all on the Canberra. So if you're taking photographs, you're taking them generally above 250 feet because you want a wider field of view, especially with troops on the ground. And generally, for the low-level side of it, we'd take it from the left-hand camera, the oblique camera, the F95 on the left-hand side. And on the side of the Canberra, there'd be a chinograph mark, which you would just run down. So you get your target. Basically, the chinograph mark would try and put your target a third of the way up of the photograph, and that's what you do. Very high-tech. But the nav, obviously, when you get airborne, he's in the back. And then he crawls down the front. It was always good fun. As he crawled down the front, you just bunt over and you'd come up like this guy. But then he crawl down the front and he would navigate, obviously, with a map from the front. And he'd take you to the target. He'd give you directions left, right, da da da. You'd have a map yourself, but he'd have a map and he'd take you to the target.
So I've heard, because it's quite a big aircraft, was it quite manoeuvrable? I've heard stories that it is.
It is, yeah. I mean, I remember I got grounded on the first 3 months on the squad, and my mate Jerry Dent, was flying at Canberra, and I came up alongside him. I pulled up in front of him. I did a barrel roll right around in front of him like that. Unfortunately, it wasn't Jerry, it was the boss. So he dragged me in and he said, he gave me a telling off, and he grounded me for 2 weeks.
Oh dear.
It was probably a good lesson, because I mean you couldn't mess around with a Canberra. He wasn't a fighter,
yeah.
And you know, a friend of mine sadly was killed doing a wing over. He tried to do a bounce on something and he pulled up. It was very, very heavy, and he just stalled in and he was killed. So it probably did me a good, actually, to be grounded for a while, but nothing worse than being overconfident.
So did you ever get bounced by other fighters and to test your skills?
Yeah, got bounced. There was a classic one. We used to do high-level exercises as well, and there used to be star fighters there, and they come up alongside you. And this star fighter, as it came alongside you, as soon as it came alongside you, you close the throttles, of course, because the camera is big wing to sit there, and the star fighter, with the nose would come up, eventually you see the reheat come on, and far out as he stopped himself stalling.
So, how high and fast could it fly?
I don't know, we're up to 35,000 feet, you know, I don't know, 0.72, I don't know what, I can't remember now, really. It's 45 years ago, you remember. Yeah. But generally, when we're flying high level, it was just burning holes in the sky.
Yeah.
We used to do basic training requirements, so we had to get the hours in, so we'd be up flying around, especially at night, just doing the routes at night. So, yeah, about 35,000 feet, I suppose.
So, how many variants did you fly?
The T4 and the B2 and the PR7. On one trip we were low level and the oil pressure fell to zero, so we had to shut the right engine down.
And the
Canberra's notorious for on single engine work. The problem was, he used to teach you on when he came around final turn, he used to bring the speed back quite a lot towards VMCA. And of course, if speed dropped, you could actually get a situation where if you put power on, the airplane would flick. And it's a bit like the Meteor. At the Meteor, they lost a lot of airplanes practicing single engine work. And I actually lost a friend subsequently about 5 years later who was practicing isometric work, single engine work, and the airplane flicked in. So you got to be very careful. So on that occasion, I just came on finals a bit fast, to say the least. You know, about 100 feet, closed both throttles and just glid onto the runway about 2,000 foot down and just rolled to a stop. So that's my only time I had an engine fail on a Canberra, but it was an interesting exercise.
Right, we're here with 779. Did you ever fly that?
Yes, I flew, I think, 30 hours on 779. Just the normal low-level recce around Germany, really, with my nav, Nobby Clark.
Could you tell any missions you actually, or sorties that you flew with 779?
There were two sorties. I flew 779, and it was towards the end of my flying on 31 Squadron, and they were both Army in the field. So you know, the first one was just flying through the training area, photographing the army, as I said before, doing a vis rep. And the second time it was more of a flyby. So we were able to fly, well, over the army about 50 feet and catch them all out having their dinner or whatever and photograph at the same time. And I think I've got some picture, I think Darren's got some picture of the army sitting in the field having the lunch. So they're the two ones I remember. I looked in my logbook before I came and they're the two ones I remember.
So what happened after you left the camera?
Well, I was posted onto Buccaneers. So I went from Larbrook to Honington, but you don't actually start flying the Buccaneer straight away. And after a few weeks in Honington, I was sent down to Chivenor. And Chivenor is a place that every potential fast jet pilot wants to go. It's a fabulous airfield. It's down near Barnstable. Super weather factor. You've got weapons ranges across the Bristol Channel at Pembrey. And you have the air weapons ranges just to the southwest of Chivenor. And of course, the most important thing is an airfield full of hunters.
Ken chats about flying the Hawker Hunter.
So Chivenor, you know, it's a pretty hard school. I mean, it's a place where a lot of ex-hunter guys were there teaching you to fly the aeroplane. Very experienced hunter guys, QFIs. And they took no prisoners, so you know, it's a course whereby you had to pass, and you had to set a reasonable standard. So arrived there and did the normal ground school, and we did a bit of, I think it was procedure training on the Hunter. And then my first flight on the Hunter was in the T7. And I flew with this instructor who was a bit of an oddball. And we got to the end of the runway, and he said, Ken, you used to fly the camera, did you? I said, yes. He said, well, and he reached over and he switched the flying controls off, the hydraulic flying controls off. And he says, well, then this is just be like flying a Canberra. So my first ever takeoff in a Hunter was in manual. I always remember rolling down the runway and pulling back on the stick. And it was a bit like trying to fly the local council bin lorry. You know, it was really heavy on the controls. And this guy thought it was funny, totally funny. So we got airborne, of course. He put the flying controls back on, the powered flying controls back on again. I immediately started over-controlling because it was so twitchy. And he raised the gear and the flaps, and off it went. You know, he thought it was funny. He enjoyed himself, but I think they were a bit sceptical about Canberra pilots coming onto the Hunter and passing the course. So I got the message there that, you know, we're going to have to do a good job to pass the course, that's for sure. Go on.
So what was it like to fly? Because obviously everyone loves the Hunter.
Well, the Hunter's the jet-powered Spitfire. You know, it's what everyone wants to fly. It was a fabulous airplane. It looked good, you know, and it flew as a fighter should. So we'd do the thing, pound the circuit. Once you've been solo, I think we'd solo in an F6. And then we'd start doing more interesting work, which is a weapons work. And we'd go over to Pembrey range, and we were either flying snare rockets or we'd be firing the Aden cannons on the targets there. Or we would go up to air-to-air firing, and you'd have a Hunter with a big long rope on the back of it, with a flag on the back of it. And you'd sit up on the perch, the aeroplane, so you'd sit on the perch and you'd dive down and you'd fire at the flag. And all the shells you had were all colour-coded, so red, orange, whatever, so that when they landed, they'd lay the flag out on the tarmac and you'd count the number of shells that went through. Well, it was, I had the feeling that being a camera pilot, they painted all my shells with varnish because it never seems to hit the flag. Anyway, so that was all a bit of fun. So, yes, once we'd done that, then I flew the 9, and then we did some lot of low level, obviously, and I flew the FR-10. So it was great. It was a great time, you know. It was a hard school, and yes, I lost a few friends who failed the course, but I thoroughly enjoyed it. And the most important thing, it was down near Barnstable. I had a great time flying in the aeroplane. I had a great social life down there as well, so it was great fun. And then when we finished that, I came out to Honington.
So how many hours did you get on the Hunter?
40 hours on the Hunter, probably like that, you know. So it's quite good because, in fact, I flew the Hunter. Subsequently, when I actually went on the squadrons, I ended up flying the Hunter on the squadron as well, because you had a Hunter T7A, which had a Buccaneer flight instrument system in it. So I ended up flying that as well.
Ken chats about flying the Blackburn Buccaneer, including stories from Red Flag.
So after Chivenor, I went back to Honington again and started the ground school on the Buccaneer. The ground school, I think, was 2 or 3 weeks, whatever. And then because there's no twin stick buccaneer, just a nav in the back there's no stick in the back, we'd do something like, I think, 12 or 13 simulator rides. They had a full mission simulator there, which we'd actually use. So we'd do 12 or 13 simulator rides first. And from there, we'd go and fly the Hunter T7A, which is a Hunter T7 with a buccaneer flight instrument system in it. And we'd do three trips on that just to get used to the flying the airplane around with that instrument system. After that, then, with the first trip in the Buccaneers with a QFI in the back, and the guy in the back of the Buccaneer for me was Tom Eales. You probably heard his name. We referred to as Mr. Buccaneer. He'd done everything in the Buccaneer, including eject. He had to eject with his navigator, doing exactly the same sort of exercise up at Lossiemouth, and him and his navigator ejected. Anyway, so the first Buccaneer trip was with Tom Eales in the back. Lovely guy, and he was just very kind and spoke very gently in the back there. Didn't raise his voice, surprisingly, because the Buccaneer could be a bit of a pig in the circuit. So we did a circuit and landed, and it was all fine. So that was the first trip in a Buccaneer, really. But Tom Eales did a lot of the first trips in Buccaneers, sitting in the back.
Can you tell us how long your training lasted for, and what does it entail?
I think the training was about 6 or 7 months. I think we did about 60 or 70 hours in the aeroplane, some of that. Yes, first of all, of course, you flew with Tom, you did your first flight, and then you would fly with the staff navigators, who were very experienced guys. So you'd go off and do weapons, etc., with those guys there. And then you'd crew it with your own navigator, and I crewed it with my nav, Les Gibson, who I flew with in total over the next few years, 380 times. So it was a lot of... once you crewed it with someone, you stay with them, and that was your constituted crew. So that's what we did. We spent a lot of time together flying low-level navexes up and down the east coast of UK. We used to drop bombs at Wainfleet, Cowden Range, up to Tain Range occasionally, and Holbeach Range down south. So we did a lot of weaponry, or dropping bombs, on the east coast, and of course a lot of navigation. And the Buccaneer really was designed for the Navy. It was designed effectively to toss a nuclear weapon onto a Sverdlov cruiser, you know, and so the navigation and the weapon system, the integrated weapon system, was designed really for that in mind. So the navs were superb. They adapted the system, and they got used to the system for going over land, and it was a satisfactory system, but they had to interpret it all the time. Yeah, instead of an inertial nav system, they had a master reference gyro, that's it, which powered the weapon system, and it tended to slip and whatever, so it wasn't as accurate as you would expect an inertial nav to be. So the navs were superb, they're interpreting the information, and of course they used to use a map all the time as well for the target runs. So that was it. We did a lot of what they called SAPs, which is a simulated attack profile, which is where you'd plan the attack, obviously not draw weapons, but you'd simulate the weren't dropping of weapons.
So when you first stepped into the cockpit, how did it differ to the camera?
Well, first of all, you know, you weren't seen to one side of the aeroplane, and the view is actually superb. The nose drops away in front of you, so you can see down in front. The nav, of course, he's sitting to one side, so he can see down the front as well. So it's a vastly different aeroplane. Obviously, the camera, a big straight-wing aeroplane with no power controls, and the Buccaneer was fully power controlled. So it was a vastly different aeroplane, and a vastly different power as well. The engines of the spay engines on the Buccaneer were a lot more powerful than the Avons on the Canberra.
So could you tell us a bit about your time on the OCU? What did it involve? A day in a life would be great.
Well, a day in life on the OCU really was when you arrived at work, as a crew, you'd be given a task to do, my nav, Les Gibson. So you'd sit down and plan the task, which would be planning it on a map. And when you're doing SAPs, you'd be plan a target, IP, initial point to target run. And you both have a copy of the map. And then you get airborne and you fly the profile, low level. Or high level, then low level, and then come back to Honington for a full debrief with the instructors back at Honington.
So what happened after the OCU? Where did you get posted to?
From the OCU, I was posted to 16 Squadron, and when I arrived there, of course, there was no airplanes on 16 Squadron. 16 camera squad had shut down, and they're just an empty hangar really. So for about 3 months we just prepared the hangar ready for the aeroplanes to arrive. I think it was 3 or 4 months. We just planned briefing rooms, and we had set up NBC facilities, nuclear, biological and chemical facilities, so that we could actually operate in a wartime environment. So all that was set up prior to the aeroplanes arriving in about, was it 1972? I think it was 72, yeah.
Did their thoughts scare you, the whole nuclear thing, and you might have to drop a bomb?
No, not really. I mean, the whole point about a nuclear deterrent was that a nuclear weapon is a weapon of last resort. So, you know, we never thought we were ever going to have to actually drop the weapon. The idea being that we were a very effective squadron and we were very effective at what we were doing. And that's what was the deterrent. That was the whole point about it, really.
So what was the role of 16 Squadron?
Well, we just mentioned really the 16 Squadron, the Buccaneer obviously had a strike capability. When we tend to refer to strike as the nuclear side of it, nuclear strike capability, and the weapon we used on the Buccaneer was a WE-177 weapon, nuclear weapon, with a yield of about 10 kilotons, if I remember rightly, which is about half the size of the bomb that was dropped on Nagasaki. So we would actually, the idea would be that we'd fly into the target, and about 4 miles before the target, we would do a toss attack, and we would lob this nuclear weapon towards the target, and it would be on a parachute or on a retarded. And the idea was being that the weapon would be an airburst. An airburst meant that the fireball doesn't touch the ground, so it's, as a tactical weapon, it means that the fireball goes up and you get very little residual fallout. So that in theory, obviously it would never happen, in theory the area is not being contaminated with the radioactive fallout, so your troops could actually go straight through. And that's why they were able to build Nagasaki and Hiroshima so quickly, because it was an airburst. And whilst it devastated, a terrible devastation, there wasn't a lot of residual radiation. If you think about Chernobyl, there's a lot of fallout from the reactor there. That's, that area now is unusable for years and years and years. So that's what an airburst was. It was a terrible weapon, don't get me wrong. It was a, you know, the bursts from the weapon, obviously there's a massive fireball and there's radiation from the fireball, and the fireball will go upwards, but the blast would go down. It's like a tennis ball. It hits the ground and the bottom of the fireball, bottom of the blast would go upwards again. So you get an outward movement of the blast wave and a reflective blast wave as well. So when it hit the ground, it just wipe out anything. So it was a devastating weapon, and that's why it was such a good deterrent. I mean, the thought of chucking one of those nuclear weapons at targets, you know, troops, whatever, on the ground, were just devastating. So kept the peace, you know, that's what we do. And that's the whole point of deterrence, really.
So, Ken, were there any incidents on 16 Squadron?
Well, we used to fly low level around Germany all the time, obviously, and most of our flying was doing SAPs, as I said before, simulated attack profiles. So we would fly a target, attack the target, say a dive attack, and often we'd then leave that target and we'd then fly through Nordhorn range and drop some bombs. So our whole life was generally flying around Germany low level, between 250 knots, 250 feet, and 500 feet, generally about 200 feet, 250 feet. And we'd use Nordhorn range. And what we used to do, of course, we'd have a time on target. So you'd do your SAPs, and then you'd have what we call a first run attack. So you'd fly through Nordhorn range at a time. So I was flying low level with Les Gibson, and we were a bit behind time for our first run attack. And we got up to about 540 knots, about 200 feet. And we hit a crane.
As you do?
Yeah, not that sort of crane with a hook on the end, but a crane that was doing this.
Yeah, yeah, right, yes, yeah.
You know, it was trying to avoid the aeroplane, yeah. You know, but he went straight on the right-hand engine, and the engine just stopped. So we returned to Larbrook, and it's not like a Canberra, that the Buccaneer is fairly easy to fly on one engine, plenty of power, there's no asymmetric problem at all. And we're back to Larbrook and landed there. Obviously an engine change, there wasn't much left of the engine really, so it almost totally destroyed the engine.
And a crane is not small though,
is it? It's not, you know, it actually dented all the intake as well as it went in with its wings out like this, yeah.
Was it aircraft savable, or was it just the engines that needed?
It was just the engine, yeah, just change the engine, change the spare, yeah. I left Germany, RAF Germany, and we went to 208 Squadron. and I joined with my navigator, John Broadbent, and we joined 2A Squadron. And the role of 2A Squadron was totally different to Germany. As I said before, Germany was a very defined role. 2A Squadron, it was the northern theatre of NATO, and you're really looking at the northern Denmark and then Norway, all the way up Norway, up the Kola Peninsula. So we weren't really sort of having an interdiction role, really. We were really more of a airfield denial role. If you can think about it, Norway's a long way away, so it's very difficult for 2A Squadron to actually operate in Norway. So what we'd do, we would actually obviously operate in UK and occasionally go to Norway. But to go to Norway, of course, you need to refuel. And that's where the tanking came into it. Air-to-air refueling. So on 2A Squadron, we'd start off, we'd go off initially and we would join the tanker. A tanker, a Victor tanker, you'd sit on station, you're doing a standard racetrack pattern on the tanker would, and we'd just join up on the left-hand wing. And then we'd drop down behind the tanker. And then obviously with the probe here, there's the effect of the nose on the basket of the tanker. So what we'd do, you'd come up behind the drogue and you'd put the probe there in about the 1 o'clock position. Then you'd move forward. As you move forward, the airflow over the nose of the airplane would push the drogue up, and you just plug in. When you're plugged in, you'd actually then move forward. I think there was a red band or green band, a red band, which you'd move forward until the red band went into the refueling pod. And once you got it, the red band was in the refueling pod, the fuel would start flowing. So you actually flew along, maintaining that distance so that the fuel flowed. And then you'd pull off, and then the other guy would come out and refuel. It was never a relaxing exercise. We never did enough of it, really. And of course, is it fairly easy when the guys were flying straight and level on the racetrack? But of course, they'd say clear to join in the turn. So the Victor tanker was in a turn like that. So you'd actually join in the turn, which was always interesting, of course. And once we'd achieved doing it in the daytime, we would end up then doing it at night. It was always good for an exercise doing tanking at night.
Scary
was the right word for it, because you'd go off at night, a gin clear night. You'd have the stars above you. You'd have the North Sea oil rigs beneath you. So there were lights everywhere. And they'll say clear to join the turn. So you're joining the bloody turn, and you're in like this, and you've got the stars up there and the stars down here, and you'd come in and join and plug in, get your fuel. And then when you came out, of course, it's enormously disorientating, you know, because you've got the clear skies and the lights beneath you, and you pull off and then drop back. But night refueling was an interesting exercise.
I didn't have to do that.
Yeah. You can tell a pilot, you know. Yeah.
So you also operated the Buccaneer in Red Flag. How did this happen?
Well, what happened was that I was on 2A Squadron, and John Broadbent and I were asked to go on to the QWI course, which is a pretty comprehensive course on the Buccaneers. A very difficult course, very pedantic course. It's a course whereby you're expected to have to perfection the whole time from your briefings and your board work, your briefings, your debriefings, and your flying, all the rest of it. So it's a throwback to the Navy. It's an incredibly difficult course to do. Well, I was on the QWI course with John, and 2A Squadron was sent out to Red Flag. And because they were going out to Red Flag, the QWI course was attached to 2A Squadron to go out to Red Flag. So we flew out with them to Nellis Air Force Base, and we operate a different unit, really. There were eight of us. There was two instructors and there was three pairs. I was lucky with my name, John Broadbent. So we arrived out in Red Flag, and of course the Americans couldn't believe it. You know. These Buccaneers arrived over there, and they looked pretty archaic compared with, you know, the F-15s, the F-16s, even the F-5s, you know, the Americans were like. So and of course they quickly got aware of the fact it was called the banana bomber, so they loved calling it the banana bomber. Do you know why it's called the banana bomber?
Is it because it looks kind of like a
banana? No, that's where we get wrong. It's actually when it designed it was called the Blackburn Naval Aircraft, the BNA. Then it became the Blackburn Advanced Naval Aircraft, the BNA, So then the BNA bomber, Barna bomber, banana bomber, that's how it came about. So nothing to do with a bloody banana. So anyway, that's the way it is. So a red flag, and you know, a very intense, I think 2 or 3 weeks he was there. And I think a lot of people have heard about it, the Buccaneers flying low level and doing well. But I don't think the story's ever been really told, that it's only half the story about what you know, flying low level. And the other half story is the navigators. The navigators were superb. You know, they made red flag, and I'll just go through and explain to you sort of a typical mission, if you like. Go through that. We'd arrive in the morning. We'd be given our task. Say we're given an airfield attack. Say tossing a 1,000-pounder, tossing a stick of 1,000-pounders. We only toss one. Tossing a 1,000-pounder. Someone coming through for a lay-down attack, then a couple of guys doing a couple of dive attacks to take out the infrastructure. The lay-down attack would try and take out the runway, laying a stick of bombs down. So you'd plan the coordinated attack, and the coordinated attack relied enormously on the timeline. Is that you'd pick your IPs for the target, and obviously you want to try and come in different directions to confuse the enemy. And then you'd work backwards. You know, you can often work in a few timing points where you can delay or pick up time, whatever. And then you work the route back. So we'd be planning that. We'd plan the route. My nav would plan the route, and we'd delegate the other navigators to plan their IP to target. If I was leading the formation, would prepare the briefing, etc. And then we'd brief the mission. We'd brief what we're going to do. And then walk out the airplanes and get airborne in two pairs, and we'd fly to the exercise area at about 5-10,000 feet, I don't know what it was, in battle formation. And then we'll descend into the tactical area, and we'll descend low level, say that to about 100 feet initially. And as we came towards we're flying over the desert, flat desert, as we came to the cap area where you got a combat air patrol in front of you, we'd descend down to about 10 feet, something like that, about 550 knots. But we found that, you know, that at that height, we were actually leaving dust trails a bit, so we just climbed up a bit to 20 feet, something like that, so we didn't leave any dust trails. So we'd see the cap, we'd see the airplanes, and you couldn't, at 20 feet, they couldn't touch you, really. You couldn't get a gun's kill with a lead on a gun. And a missile, even as far, it would probably hit the ground before it hit you anyway. So they couldn't get a kill at any time, the fighters on the Buccaneers. So, as I said to you, the navigators in the back, of course, they were monitoring all this. We were going high speed, 540 knots, and they were running the timeline. They're keeping an eye on the time on the target. We had a time on target. We had to make the time on target. And when we got the target, we had to have spacing on the target. You had 30-second spacing, say, on toss the weapon, then you'd have somebody coming through and you'd lay down 30 seconds later. So the time was crucial, really, for the attacks. So anyway, we'd progress along the desert, and then we came up towards the hills there, and the fighters would expect us to if that was a hill there, to climb up and push over the top like that, and the fighter would come down behind and try and get a sky shot. You were actually skylining, and they would try and get a sky shot like that. But the Buccaneer didn't do that. The Buccaneer would come up to a hill, as that it was a hill, instead of skying like that, the Buccaneer would just come up the hill and go to the top about 50 feet over the hill and pull down the valley there, so pulling about 4 or 5 G over the top down into the valley. And this is where the navigators, again, they were superb, you know, keeping pace of what was going on, because the kit in the back wasn't wonderful. The nav kit, as I mentioned before, was designed for the Navy, really. So the lead navigator would be keeping an eye on what was going on the whole time. All the other navigators were aware of what was going on. If you got severely delayed or whatever, you could always retime it by saying time so-and-so, and everybody else would take the time from that. So then we'd attack the airfield, and of course, you're going through, once you've gone through the cap, you've got the missile sites you're flying through, and of course, you're flying pretty low, you know, you're down 50, 20, 30 feet, so your missile's tending point upwards, not downwards.
No.
So, they had no chance, really. And then you came to your target, so the lead guy would toss his weapon. And of course, the thing about tossing a weapon is that on a medium toss is that you toss the weapon, as soon as the better weapons have gone, you pull into a hard pull down at 4 or 5 G, 150 degrees of bank. So there's no chance of a missile. You know, the airplane's moving so much. And then there's a lay down attack where you would drop a stick of bombs, say. The idea of a lay down attack was that you drop, say, four bombs with a spacing. You never flew down the runway to take out a runway. You always flew about 30 degrees to it, so you can guarantee you maybe got one bomb on the runway. If you flew down the runway, all the bombs would go to the right or left of the runway, you see. So that's the idea of a stick of bombs. So lay down attack. And then the guys who came in to do the shallow angle dive bombing would pull up again, and the airplane was moving all the time, so the chance of being shot down by a missile were very remote, so they'd drop their bombs and then scoot out. The guy that had the hard time, of course, was the guy doing a lay down attack. And the difficult lay down was that you were limited to your height. You couldn't come in really low level on a lay down attack. Every weapon on an airplane or a missile, when it leaves the missile launcher or when the bomb leaves the airplane, is not armed. A missile, when it's launched, it's armed when it accelerates to a certain speed. On a bomb, a retard bomb, when you drop the bomb, there's an arming vane on the back, and it arms the bomb, and it needs 130 feet to arm. So you have to find level, minimum about 150 feet. And the classic example of this is in the Falklands War. I don't remember that. The BBC showing the pictures of these A4 Skyhawks coming down the bay. And I was in Glasgow at the time. I was flying the Monarch Airlines. And I saw these pictures, and as soon as I saw them, I thought, I can't believe that, because these airplanes are coming low and dropping their bombs, and they weren't going off. And they weren't going off because they were too low. So thanks to the BBC, of course, the Argentinians said, oh, that's great, our bombs aren't going off. So what they did, they changed their attack to shallow dive bombing with 500-pound retard bombs. And that's what Trigala Sagana had. Anyway, you know, that's a different story. So anyway, so yes, so 150 feet is the minimum you can drop a 1,000-pound bomb from. And from there, you'd reform, and then you'd go around area 51, which is the most secret place in America, avoiding Area 51. And we would come round and we would do a running break and land. We'd then go in and debrief ourselves, just the eight of us would debrief ourselves. And then we would later would go into the mass debrief, and that's everybody from that morning, those missions were there, all the Americans were there, and you'd go in there, and all these guys sitting there, their smart tailored flying suits, you know, and their Ray-Bans and their bloody baseball hats, all the rest of it. And you'd go in there and your RAF flying suit with great salt stains down the side, and you stand up there and you'd say, this is the mission we did, and you'd say we flew low level and under the cap, and we went down over the hills, and we attacked the target on time, and we dropped our weapons, and we recovered back to Nellis Air Force Base. And then they'd say to me, okay, they asked the aggressor squadrons, anybody got a missile or a guns kill? No. And then they asked the missile sites, anybody got a missile kill? No. And it was great. And the Americans, of course, they'd have gone, whoop, 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 whoop.
Yeah.
Because of being the Air Force, who said, thank you very much, and just walked away. So it was great. I mean, they were quite impressed with the Buccaneer. But the point I'm making is that, you know, it wasn't just about pilots flying low level. The navigators had a massive input into Red Flag, and I don't think they often get the press they deserve. You know, it was a crew airplane, and these guys have been flying together a lot, the crews, the constituted crews. And to maintain a timeline and to be able to hit a target on time was an enormous skill, and that was down to the navigators.
You couldn't have done the job without the navigator.
No. And I say it wasn't a design for the Buccaneer, for the overland role, the integrated weapon system. So, you know, they did a superb job. So that was it. Yeah, that was Red Flag, and we all enjoyed it. We had a bit of time down in Las Vegas, obviously, and we had a few parties, and it was just a superb time. It was an opportunity to fly extremely low level and get some good results. So once we finished Red Flag, I was still on the QDR course, and we'd had a great time. We went back to Honington, and we had another week or 10 days flying low level, doing all the stuff that the QDRs do. And when we finished the course, John and I went back to 208 Squadron, and what happened then was that the weapons leader got promoted, got moved on to being a flight commander, and I was asked to take over a weapons leader on the squadron. John went off in his own way. He went off to fly with other people. And I ended up flying with a lot of the navigators on the squadron because, obviously, as a weapons leader, I had to fly with everybody. Although I was crewed up with Al Vincent. And with Al, I flew 431, you know, quite a few times. 431 actually flew in Red Flag. I flew it in Red Flag. And then my final flight was on 431 on 208 Squadron. So, you know, that's my final aeroplane over there. I flew on the Canberra, and this is the final Buccaneer I flew here on 208 Squadron.
So overall, did you enjoy your time on the Buccaneer?
Oh, yes. I mean, it was the most thrilling experience you ever imagined, really. You could do no more than we did on the Buccaneer, apart from land on an aircraft carrier, which some guys did. You know, they obviously went off the Navy, but I don't think I've done any more on the Buccaneer than I did. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
And how many hours did you acquire on the
1,200, something like that. Yeah, it was very mad. With John, like I said, Les, I did 380 missions with 350 missions with Les. I did about 280 with John. So you fly with a guy you trust,
yeah,
as a crew, you know, and that's what makes the Buccaneer so successful, because you fly as a constituted crew. So yeah, I loved it. So my last flight on the Buccaneer was with Al Vincent, and we led two F-104s to Salisbury Plain. And then we came, the Dutch 104s, they broke off and went back to Holland. And I came back and did a bit of a fly past the airfield.
One of the famous pictures.
Yes. I was just descending past the tower, you know, to fly down the apron there.
Yeah.
15-10-10, gear down, and then just did a circuit and landed, really. But that was our last flight on the Buccaneer.
Brilliant.
And finally, we get to hear a personal side of Ken.
So, Ken, do you have any hobbies?
Yes, I was a trained engineer, so I've always been interested in engineering. So I got myself a little MGTD car, which I brought back to South Africa many, many years ago. And I've been rebuilding it, but I've been rebuilding it for a long time. I'm still fiddling around with it. I've probably got another few months to go before it's back on the road again. So that's really my main hobby, I suppose. Also, I got five dogs, so... Yeah, they get pretty involved with those as well, so...
Keep you busy.
Yeah, it does, yeah.
Do you have a favourite aircraft?
I suppose the two, the Buccaneer is my favourite aeroplane for the Royal Air Force, and of course I did 33 years in civil aviation with the Monarch Airlines, and I flew the 757 for 27 years and the 767, so I suppose the 757 and 767 are my best. I enjoyed flying those, but the Buccaneer, obviously, I think is probably my most favourite aircraft, I suppose.
Is there an aircraft you wish you could have flown?
No. I mean, I look back to the days when I met Kevin Mace in the Merchant Navy, and he was in a Valley, and I looked to think, well, I'd love to go to Valley and do that. And I look back at my journey through the Air Force, you know, the Nat and the Canberra and the Buccaneer and the Hunter, you know. And I think Jensen Button tomorrow is doing his last race in Formula One, and on his helmet it just says, "The journey is the reward." Mm-hmm. And to me, that sums it all up. You know, it's the journey through the training, through the squadrons, is the reward. And I don't look back and think that I would like to fly anything else. Yes, I'd love to, I suppose, lightning, all that sort of stuff, but I didn't. I did the most I could do. The airplanes I flew, I thought it was superb.
Do you get to air shows?
Occasionally, not very often these days, unfortunately. There's not many air shows, are there, really? I've been to Bronte, you know, Bronte Thorpe, seeing the guys down there. So, no, not really, no.
So, how much involvement do you have with 779 and 431?
Well, I try and help when I can. Obviously, these guys put a lot of work into these aeroplanes, and I can't do much for that, but I help them out when I can. Whatever I can do, I'll help them out with, you know. So, I've done one or two things for them, you know. So, they do such a great job, because aeroplanes tend to, you know, go into museums in London or whatever, but these aeroplanes aren't in museums. These guys have bought these aircraft, they spend their own money on them, and they drag them around various air shows, whatever, and kids can sit in them. You look over there now, there are kids in the Buccaneer, you know. So maybe one of these kids here see these aeroplanes, think, yes, I want to be a pilot, I want to join the Air Force or whatever, so inspires them to do that. So I think they do a great job, you know, Andrew and Darren, and all the other guys as well.
So must be nice actually seeing the aircraft you actually flew, rather than just a Canberra or Buccaneer. The actual ones you flew must be lovely.
Well, I mean, it's unique. I mean, you think about it, I've flew this aeroplane. It was the last aeroplane I flew in the Air Force, and the Buccaneer was the last Buccaneer I flew in the Air Force. So you can imagine, you know, it's great to have them around.
And finally, do you ever get sick about talking about aviation?
Flying aeroplanes for 45 years, you know, so no, not really. Pilots never get sick of talking about flying aeroplanes.
Thanks very much for listening. We hope you've enjoyed this episode. And don't forget, you can watch and listen to all of our other interviews at aircrewinterview.tv. Also, please sign up to our newsletter for exclusive content, prizes, upcoming interviews, and much more. And of course, go over to patreon.com/aircrewinterview to help us grow and to become part of the team for as little as $1 per month. Thank you, and see you soon.